This is Audible.
Time Warner Audiobooks presents 3 Weeks with My Brother, written by Nicholas and Micah Sparks, and read by Henry Layla, with an introduction by Nicholas Sparks.
A friend is always loyal, and a brother is born to help in time of need. Proverbs 17:17. Prologue. This book came about because of a brochure I received in the mail in the spring of 2002. It was a typical day in the Sparks household. I'd spent a good part of the morning and early afternoon working on my novel, Nights in Rodanthe, but it hadn't gone well and I was struggling to put the day behind me. I hadn't written as much as I'd intended, nor did I have any idea of what I would write the following day, so I wasn't in the best of moods when I finally turned off the computer and called it quits for the afternoon. It isn't easy living with an author. I know this because my wife has informed me of this fact, and she did so again that day. To be honest, it's not the easiest thing to hear, and while it would be easy to get defensive, I've come to understand that arguing with her about it has never solved anything. So, instead of denying it, I've learned to take her hands, look her in the eyes, and respond with those 3 magic words that every woman wants to hear. You're right, sweetheart. Some people believe that because I've been relatively successful as an author, writing must come easily to me. Many people imagine that I jot down ideas as they come to me for a few hours each day, then spend the rest of my time relaxing by the pool with my wife while we discuss our next exotic vacation. In reality, our lives aren't that much different from that of your average middle-class family. We don't have a staff of servants or travel extensively, and while we do have a pool in the backyard surrounded by pool chairs, I honestly can't remember a time that the chairs have ever been used, simply because neither my wife nor I have much time during the day to sit around doing nothing. For me, the reason is my work. For my wife, the reason is family, or, more specifically, kids. We have 5 children, you see. Not a big number if we were pioneers, but these days it's enough to raise a few eyebrows. Last year, when my wife and I were on a trip, we happened to strike up a conversation with another young couple. One topic led to another, and finally the subject of kids came up. That couple had 2 kids and mentioned their names. My wife rattled off the names of ours. For a moment, the conversation ground to a halt while the other woman tried to figure out whether she'd heard us correctly. "You have 5 kids?" the woman finally asked. "Yes." She laid a sympathetic hand on my wife's shoulder. "Are you insane?" "Our sons are 12, 10, and 4. Our twin daughters are coming up on 3, and while there's a lot that I don't know about the world, I do know that kids have a funny way of helping you keep things in perspective. The older ones know that I write novels for a living, though I sometimes doubt that either of them understands what it means to create a work of fiction. For instance, when my 10-year-old was asked what his father did for a living during a class presentation, he puffed his chest out and proudly declared, "My daddy plays on the computer all day." My oldest son, on the other hand, often tells me, with utter solemnity, of course, that writing is easy. It's just the typing that's hard. I work out of the house as many authors do, but I suppose that's where the resemblance ends. My office isn't some upstairs, out-of-the-way sanctuary. Instead, the door opens directly onto the living room. While I've read that some authors must have a quiet house in order to concentrate, I'm fortunate in that I've never needed silence to work. It's a good thing, I suppose, or I never would have written at all. Our house, you have to understand, is a whirlwind of activity, literally from the moment my wife and I get out of bed until the moment we collapse back into it at the end of the day. Spending the day at our home is enough to exhaust just about anyone. First off, our kids have energy. Lots and lots of energy. Ridiculous amounts of energy. Multiplied by 5, it's enough energy to power the city of Cleveland. And the kids somehow magically feed off each other's energy, each consuming and mirroring the others. Then our 3 dogs feed off it, and then the house itself seems to feed off it. A typical day includes at least 1 sick child, toys strewn from one end of the living room to the other that magically reappear the moment after they've been put away, dogs barking, kids laughing, the phone ringing off the hook, FedEx and UPS deliveries coming and going, kids whining, lost homework, appliances breaking, school projects due tomorrow that our kids somehow forget to tell us about until the last minute. Baseball practice, gymnastics practice, football practice, taekwondo practice, repairmen coming and going, doors slamming, kids running down the hallway, kids throwing things, kids teasing each other, kids asking for snacks, kids crying because they fell, kids cuddling up on your lap, or kids crying because they need you right this minute. When my in-laws leave after visiting for a week, they can't get to the airport soon enough. There are deep bags under their eyes, and they carry the dazed, shell-shocked expression of veterans who just survived the landing on Omaha Beach. Instead of saying goodbye, my father-in-law shakes his head and whispers, "Good luck. You're going to need it." My wife accepts all of this activity in the house as normal. She's patient and seldom gets flustered. My wife seems to actually enjoy it most of the time. My wife, I might add, is a saint. Either that, or maybe she is insane. In our house, it's my job to handle the mail. It has to be done, after all, and in the course of our marriage, this is one of those little responsibilities that has fallen in my lap. The day that I received the brochure in the mail was a day like any other. Lexi, who was 6 months old, had a cold and refused to let my wife put her down. Miles had painted the dog's tail with fluorescent paint and was proudly showing it off. Ryan needed to study for a test but forgot the textbook at school and had decided to solve the problem by seeing how much toilet paper could be flushed down the toilet. Landon was coloring on the walls again, and I can't remember what Savannah was doing, but no doubt it was something distressing since at 6 months old she was already learning from her siblings. Add to that the television blaring, dinner cooking, dogs barking, and a ringing phone, and the chaotic roar seemed to be reaching a fever pitch. I suspected that even my saintly wife might be nearing the end of her rope. Pushing away from the computer, I took a deep breath and stood from my desk. Marching into the living room, I took one look around at the world gone crazy and, with instincts only men seem to possess, I knew exactly what to do. I cleared my throat, felt everyone's attention momentarily swing to me, and calmly announced, "I'm going to see if the mail's come in yet." A minute later, I was out the front door. Because our house is set a ways back from the road, it usually takes 5 minutes to walk out to the box and back. The moment I closed the door behind me, the mayhem ceased to exist. I walked slowly, savoring the silence. Once back in the house, I noticed that my wife was trying to clean the cookie crumb drool from her shirt while holding both babies simultaneously. Landon was standing at her feet, tugging at her jeans, trying to get her attention. At the same time, she was helping the older boys with their homework. My heart surged with pride at her ability to multitask so efficiently, and I held up the stack of mail so she could see it. "I got the mail," I offered. She glanced up. "I don't know what I'd do without you," she answered. "You're such a big help around here." I nodded. "Just doing my job," I said. "No reason to thank me." Like everyone else, I get my share of junk mail, and I separated the important mail from the non-important. I paid the bills, skimmed through articles and a couple of magazines, and was getting ready to toss everything else into the circular file cabinet when I noticed a brochure I'd initially put in the trash pile. It had come from the alumni office at the University of Notre Dame and advertised a journey to the lands of sky worshippers. The tour was called Heaven and Earth and would travel around the world over a 3-week period in January and February 2003. Interesting, I thought, and I began to peruse it. The tour, by private jet no less, would journey to the Mayan ruins in Guatemala, the Incan ruins in Peru, the stone giants of Easter Island, and the Polynesian Cook Islands. There would also be stops at Ayers Rock in Australia, Angkor Wat in the Killing Fields, and Holocaust Museum in Phnom Penh, Cambodia, the Taj Mahal and the Amber Fort of Jaipur in India, the rock cathedrals of Lalibela, Ethiopia, the Hypogeum and other ancient temples in Malta, and finally, weather permitting, a chance to see the northern lights in Tromsø, Norway, a town located 300 miles north of the Arctic Circle. As a child, I'd always been fascinated with ancient cultures and faraway lands, and as I read the description of each proposed stop, I found myself thinking, I've always wanted to see that. It was an opportunity to take the trip of a lifetime to places that had lingered in my imagination since boyhood. Yet, when I finished looking through the brochure, I sighed thinking, maybe one day. Right now, I just didn't have the time. 3 weeks away from the kids, from my wife, from my work? Impossible. It was ridiculous, so I might as well forget about it. I shove the brochure to the bottom of the pile. The thing is, I couldn't forget about the trip. You see, I'm a realist, and in the future, I figured that Kat and I would finally get the chance to travel. But while I knew that someday it might be possible to convince my wife to travel with me to see the Taj Mahal or Angkor Wat, there wasn't a chance we'd ever make it to Easter Island or Ethiopia or the jungles of Guatemala. Because they were so far out of the way and there were so many other things to see and places to go in the world, traveling to remote areas would always fall into the category of maybe one day, and I was fairly certain that one day would never come. But here was the chance to do it all in one fell swoop, and 10 minutes later, once the cacophony in the living room had died down as mysteriously as it had arisen, I was standing in the kitchen with my wife, the brochure open on the counter. I pointed out the highlights like a kid describing summer camp, and my wife, who has long since grown used to my flights of fancy, simply listened as I rambled on. When I finished, she nodded. "Hmm," she said. "Is that a good mm or a bad mm?" "Neither. I was just wondering why you're showing me this. It's not like we can go." "I know," I said. "I just thought you might like to see it." My wife, who knows me better than anyone, knew there was more to it than just that. "Hmm," she said. 2 days later, my wife and I were walking through the neighborhood. Our oldest sons were ahead of us, and the other three kids were in strollers when I brought the subject up again. "I was thinking about that trip," I said oh so casually. "What trip?" "The one that goes around the world, the one in the brochure that I showed you."
"Why?"
"Well," I took a deep breath, "would you like to go?" She took a few steps before answering. "Of course I'd like to go," she said. "It looks amazing, but it's impossible. I can't leave the kids for 3 weeks. What if something happened? There's not a chance that we could get back in an emergency. How many flights even go to a place like Easter Island? Lexi and Savannah are still babies, and they need me. All of them need me," she trailed off. "Maybe other mothers could go, but not me." I nodded. I'd already known what her answer would be. "Would you mind if I went?" She looked over at me. I already traveled extensively for work, touring 2 to 3 months a year, and my trips were always hard on the family. Though I wasn't always willing to dive headfirst into the chaos, I'm not completely worthless around the house. Kat has a schedule that frequently gets her out of the house. She has occasional breakfasts with friends, volunteers regularly at school, exercises at the gym, plays bunco with a group of ladies, and runs daily errands, and we both know she needs to get out of the house in order to keep from going crazy. In those moments, I end up being solo dad, but when I'm gone, it becomes difficult, if not impossible, for her to do anything outside the house. This is not good for my wife's state of mind. In addition, our kids like having both of us around. When I'm gone, if you can imagine it, the chaos in the house multiplies, as if filling the void in my absence. Suffice it to say, my wife gets rather tired of my traveling. She understands it's part of my job, but it doesn't mean that she likes it. Thus, my question was a fraught one. "Is it really that important to you?" she finally asked. "No," I said honestly. "If you don't want me to go, I won't, but I'd like to."
"And you'd go alone?"
I shook my head. "Actually, I was thinking about going with Micah," I said, referring to my brother. We walked in silence for a few moments before she caught my eye. "I think," she said, "that would be a wonderful idea." After Kat and I returned from our walk and still in a state of partial disbelief, I went to my office to call my brother in California. I could hear the phone ringing, the sound more distant than that on a landline. Micah never answered his home phone. If I ever wanted to talk to him, I had to dial his cellular. "Hey, Nikki," he chirped, "what's going on?" My brother has caller ID and still tends to call me by my childhood name. I was, in fact, called Nikki till the 5th grade. "I have something that I think you'll be interested in."
"Do tell."
"I got this brochure in the mail, and anyway, to make a long story short, I was wondering if you want to go with me on a trip around the world in January."
"What kind of trip?"
I spent the next few minutes describing the highlights, flipping through the brochure as I spoke. When I finished, he was quiet on the other end.
"Really?" he asked. "And Kat's gonna let you go?"
She said she would. I hesitated. Look, I know it's a big decision, so I don't need an answer now. We've got plenty of time until we have to confirm. I just wanted to get you thinking about it. I mean, I'm sure you'll have to clear it with Christine. 3 weeks is a long time. Christine is my brother's wife. In the background, I could hear the faint cries of their newborn baby girl, Peyton. I'm sure she'll think it's okay, but I'll check and call you back. Do you want me to send the brochure? Of course, he said. I should probably know where we're going, right? I'll FedEx it today, I said. And Micah? Yeah? This is going to be the trip of our lives. I'm sure it will be, little brother. I could almost see Micah grinning on the other end. It will be. We said our goodbyes, and after hanging up the phone, I found myself eyeing the family photographs that line the shelves of my office. For the most part, the pictures were of the kids. I saw my children as infants and as toddlers. There was a Christmas photograph of all five of them taken only a couple of months earlier. Beside that stood a photograph of Kathy, and on impulse I reached for the frame, thinking of the sacrifice she'd just made. No, she wasn't thrilled with the idea of me leaving for 3 weeks. Nor was she thrilled that I wouldn't be around to help with our five children. Instead, she'd shoulder the load while I traveled the world. Why, then, had she said yes? As I've said, my wife understands me better than anyone, and knew my urgent desire to go had less to do with the trip itself than spending time with my brother. This, then, is a story about brotherhood. It's the story of Micah and me, and the story of our family. It's a story of tragedy and joy, hope and support. It's the story of how we've matured and changed and taken different paths in life, but somehow grown even closer. It is, in other words, the story of two journeys. One journey that took my brother and me to exotic places around the world, and another, a lifetime in the making, that has somehow led us to become the best of friends.
Chapter 1. Many stories begin with a simple lesson learned, and our family story is no exception. For brevity's sake, I'll summarize. In the beginning, we children were conceived, and the lesson learned, at least according to my Catholic mother, goes like this. Always remember, she told me, no matter what the church tells you, the rhythm method doesn't work. I looked up at her, 12 years old at the time. You mean to say that we were all accidents? Yep, each and every one of you. But good accidents, right? She smiled. The very best kind. Still, after hearing this story, I wasn't sure quite what to think. On one hand, it was obvious that my mom didn't regret having us. On the other hand, it wasn't good for my ego to think of myself as an accident, or to wonder whether my sudden appearance in the world came about because of one too many glasses of champagne. Still, it did serve to clear things up for me, for I'd always wondered why our parents hadn't waited before having children. They certainly weren't ready for us, but then I'm not exactly sure they'd been ready for marriage either. Both my parents were born in 1942, and with World War II in its early stages, both of my grandfathers served in the military. My paternal grandfather was a career officer. My dad, Patrick Michael Sparks, spent his childhood moving from one military base to the next and growing up largely in the care of his mother. He was the oldest of five siblings, highly intelligent, and attended boarding school in England before his acceptance at Creighton University in Omaha, Nebraska. It was there that he met my mom, Jill Emma Marie Taney. Like my dad, my mom was the oldest child in her family. She had three younger brothers and sisters, and was mostly raised in Nebraska, where she developed a lifelong love of horses. Her father was an entrepreneur who ran a number of different businesses in the course of his life. When my mom was a teenager, he owned a movie theater in Lyons, a tiny town of a few hundred people nestled just off the highway in the midst of farmland. According to my mom, the theater was part of the reason she'd attended boarding school as well. Supposedly, she'd been sent away because she'd been caught kissing a boy. Though when I asked about it, my grandmother adamantly denied it. Your mother always was a storyteller, my grandmother informed me. She used to make up the darndest things, just to get a reaction from you kids. So why did you ship her off to boarding school? Because of all the murders, my grandmother said. Lots of young girls were getting killed in lions back then. I see. Anyway, after boarding school, my mother headed off to Creighton University just like my dad, and I suppose it was the similarities between my parents' lives that first sparked their interest in each other. Whatever the reason, they began dating as sophomores and gradually fell in love. They courted for a little more than a year and were both 21 when they married on August 31st, 1963, prior to the beginning of their senior year in college. A few months later, the rhythm method failed and my mom learned the first of her three lessons. Micah was born on December 1st, 1964. By spring, she was pregnant again, and I followed on December 31st, 1965. By the following spring, she was pregnant with my sister Dana, and decided that from that point on, she would take birth control matters into her own hands. After graduation, my dad chose to pursue a master's degree in business at the University of Minnesota, and the family moved near Watertown in the autumn of 1966. My sister Dana was born, like me, on December 31st, and my mother stayed home to raise us while my father went to school during the day and tended bar at night. Because my parents couldn't afford much in the way of rent, we lived miles from town in an old farmhouse that my mother swore was haunted. Years later, she told me that she used to see and hear things late at night, crying, laughing, and whispered conversations. But as soon as she would get up to check on us, the noises would fade away. A likelier explanation was that she was hallucinating. Not because she was crazy. My mom was probably the most stable person I've ever known. But because she must have spent those first few years in a foggy world of utter exhaustion. And I don't mean the kind of exhaustion easily remedied by a couple of days of sleeping in late. I mean the kind of unending physical, mental, and emotional exhaustion that makes a person look like they've been swirled around in circles by their earlobes for hours before being plunked down at the kitchen table in front of you. Her life must have been absolute hell. Beginning at age 25 with three babies in cloth diapers, with the exception of those times when her mother came to visit, she was completely isolated for the next 2 years. There was no family nearby to lend support. We were poor as dirt, and we lived in the middle of nowhere. Nor could my mom so much as venture into the nearest town, for my father took the car with him to both school and work. Throw in a couple of Minnesota winters where snow literally reached the roof, subtract my always busy dad from the equation, throw in the unending whining and crying of babies and toddlers, and even then I'm not sure it's possible to imagine how miserable she must have been. Nor was my father much help. At that point in his life, he simply couldn't. I've often wondered why he didn't get a regular job, but he didn't, and it was all he could do to work and study and attend his classes. He would leave first thing in the morning and return long after everyone else had gone to bed. So with the exception of three little kids, my mother had absolutely no one to talk to. She must have gone days or even weeks without having a single adult conversation. Because he was the oldest, my mom saddled Micah with responsibilities far beyond his years, certainly with more responsibility than I'd ever trust my kids with. My mom was notorious for drumming old-fashioned Midwestern values into our heads, and my brother's command soon became, "It's your job to take care of your brother and sister no matter what." Even at three, he did. He helped feed me and my sister, bathed us, entertained us, watched us as we toddled around the yard. There are pictures in our family albums of Micah rocking my sister to sleep while feeding her a bottle, despite the fact that he wasn't all that much bigger than she was. I've come to understand that it was good for him, because a person has to learn a sense of responsibility. It doesn't magically appear one day simply because you suddenly need it. But I think that because Micah was frequently treated as an adult, he actually believed he was an adult, and that certain rights were owed him. I suppose that's what led to an almost adult sense of stubborn entitlement long before he started school. My earliest memory, in fact, is about my brother. I was 2 1/2, Micah a year older, on a late summer weekend, and the grass was about a foot high. My dad was getting ready to mow the lawn and had pulled the lawnmower out from the shed. Now Micah loved the lawnmower, and I vaguely remember my brother pleading with my father to let him mow the lawn, despite the fact that he wasn't even strong enough to push it. My dad said no, of course, but my brother, all 30 pounds of him, couldn't see the logic of the situation. Nor, he told me later, was he going to put up with such nonsense. In his own words, I decided to run away. Now I know what you're thinking. He's 3.5 years old. How far could he go? My oldest son, Miles, used to threaten to run away at that age, too. And my wife and I responded thus. Go ahead. Just make sure you don't go any farther than the corner. Miles, being the gentle and fearful child that he was, would indeed go no farther than the corner, where my wife and I would watch him from the kitchen window. Not my brother. No. His thinking went like this. I'm going to run far away, and since I'm always supposed to take care of my brother and sister, then I guess I have to take them with me. So he did. He loaded my 18-month-old sister in the wagon, took my hand, and sneaking behind the hedges so my parents couldn't see us, began leading us to town. Town, by the way, was 2 miles away, and the only way to get there was to cross a busy 2-lane highway. We nearly made it, too. I remember marching through fields with weeds nearly as tall as I was, watching butterflies explode into the summer sky. We kept going for what seemed like forever before finally reaching the highway. There we stood on the shoulder of the road. 3 children under 4, mind you, and 1 in diapers, buffeted by powerful gusts of wind as 18-wheelers and cars rushed past us at 60 miles an hour, no more than a couple of feet away. I remember my brother telling me, "You have to run fast when I tell you," and the sounds of honking horns and screeching tires after he screamed, "Run!" while I toddled across the road trying to keep up with him. After that, things were a little sketchy. I remember getting tired and hungry, and finally crawling into the wagon with my sister, while my brother dragged us along like Balto, the lead husky pushing through Alaskan snow. But I also remember being proud of him. This was fun. This was an adventure. And despite everything, I felt safe. Micah would take care of me, and my command from my mother had always been, do what your brother tells you. Even then, I did as I was told. Unlike my brother, I would grow up doing what I was told. Sometime later, I remember heading over a bridge and up a hill. Once we reached the top, we could see the town in the valley below. Years later, I understood that we must have been gone for hours. Little legs can only cover 2 miles so fast, and I vaguely remember my brother promising us some ice cream to eat. Just then, we heard shouting, and as I looked over my shoulder, I saw my mother frantically rushing up the road behind us. She was screaming at us to stop while wildly waving a fly swatter over her head. That's what she used to punish us, by the way, the fly swatter. My brother hated the fly swatter. Micah was unquestionably the most frequent recipient of the fly swatter punishment. My mom liked it because even though it stung, it didn't really hurt, and it made a loud noise when connecting with a diaper or through pants. The sound was what really got to you. It's like the popping of a balloon. And to this day, I still feel a strange sort of retributive glee when I swat insects in my home. It wasn't long after the first time Micah ran away that he did it again. For whatever reason, he got in trouble, and this time it was my dad who went for the fly swatter. By then, Micah had grown tired of this particular punishment. So when he saw my father reaching for it, he said firmly, "You're not going to swat me with it." My dad turned, fly swatter in hand, and that's when Micah took off. Sitting in the living room, I watched as my 4-year-old brother raced from the kitchen, flew by me, and headed up the stairs with my dad close behind. I heard the thumping upstairs as my brother performed various unknown acrobatics in the bedroom, and a moment later, he was zipping back down the stairs, past me again, through the kitchen, and blasting through the back door, moving faster than I'd ever seen him move. My dad, huffing and puffing, he was a lifelong smoker, rumbled down the stairs and followed him. I didn't see either of them again for hours. After it was dark, when I was already in bed, I looked up to see my mom leading Micah into our room. My mom tucked him in bed and kissed him on the cheek. Despite the darkness, I could see he was filthy, smeared with dirt. He looked like he'd spent the past few hours underground. As soon as she left, I asked Micah what happened. "I told him he wasn't going to swat me," he said. "Did he?" "No, he couldn't catch me. Then he couldn't find me." I smiled, thinking, "I knew you'd make it." Chapter 2. A couple of days after I sent Micah the information about the trip, the phone rang. I was at my desk in the office, struggling through another difficult day of writing. And when I picked up the receiver, Micah began rattling on almost immediately. "This trip is amazing," he said. "Have you seen where we're going to be going? We're going to Easter Island in Cambodia. We're going to see the Taj Mahal. We're going to the Australian Outback." "I know," I said. "Doesn't it sound great?" "It's more than great. It's awesome. Did you see that we're going on a dog sled ride in Norway?" "Yeah, I know." "We'll ride elephants in India." "I know." "We're going to Africa. Africa, for God's sake." "I know." "This is going to be great." "So Christine said you could go?" "I told you I'm going." "I know, but is Christine okay with it?" "She's not exactly thrilled, but she okayed it. I mean, Africa, India, Cambodia, with my brother? What's she going to say?" She could have said no, I thought. They had two kids. Peyton was only a couple of months old. Allie was 9. And Micah was planning to leave for a month shortly after Peyton's first birthday. But like Kathy, I was certain that Christine understood that Micah needed to see me as much as I needed to see him, albeit for different reasons. As siblings, we'd come to depend on each other in times of crisis, a dependence that had grown only stronger as we aged. We'd supported each other through personal and emotional struggles. We'd lived each other's ups and downs. We'd learned a lot about ourselves by learning about each other. And while siblings by nature often are close, with Micah and me, it went a step further. The sound of his voice never failed to remind me of the childhood we'd shared, and his laughter inevitably resurrected distant memories, long-lost images unfurling without warning like flags on a breezy day. "Nick? Hello? You still there?" "Yeah, I'm here, just thinking." "About what, the trip?" "No," I said. "I was thinking about the adventures we had when we were little kids." "In Minnesota?" "No," I said. "In Los Angeles." "What made you think of that?" "I'm not exactly sure," I admitted. "Sometimes it just happens." In 1969, we moved from the cold winters of Minnesota to Inglewood, California. My dad had been accepted into the doctoral program at the University of Southern California, and we moved to what some might consider the projects. Smack dab in the center of Los Angeles, the community where we lived still smoldered with the angry memories of the Watts riots in 1965. We were one of only a few white families in the run-down apartment complex we called home, and our immediate neighbors included prostitutes, drug dealers, and gang members. It was a tiny place, 2 bedrooms, living room, and a kitchen. But I'm sure my mom viewed it as a vast improvement over her life in Minnesota. Even though she still didn't have the support of family, for the first time in 2 years she had neighbors to talk to, even if they were different from the folks she grew up with in Nebraska. It was also possible for her to walk to the store to buy groceries, or at least walk outside and see signs of human life. It's common for children to think of their parents reverentially, and as a child, I was no different. With dark brown eyes, dark hair, and milky skin, my mom seemed beautiful to me. Despite the harshness of our early life, I never remember her taking her frustrations out on us. She was one of those women who were born to be a mother, and she loved us unconditionally. In many ways, we were her life. She smiled more than anyone I've ever known. Hers weren't those fake smiles, the kind that seem forced and give you the creeps. Hers were genuine smiles that made you want to run into her arms, which were always held open for us. My dad, on the other hand, was still somewhat of a mystery to me. With sandy, reddish hair, he had freckles and was prone to sunburns. Among all of us, only he had an appreciation for music. He played the harmonica and the guitar, and he whistled compulsively when he was stressed, which he always seemed to be. Not that anyone could blame him. In Los Angeles, he settled into the same grueling routine that he had in Minnesota. Classes, studying, and working evenings as a janitor and bartender in order to provide us with the basic necessities of life. Even then, he had to rely on both his and my mom's parents to help make ends meet. When he was around the house, he was often preoccupied to the point of appearing absent-minded. My most consistent memory of my father is of him sitting at the table, head bowed over a book. A true intellectual, he wasn't the kind of dad who liked to play catch or ride bikes or go hiking. But since we'd never experienced anything different, it didn't bother us. Instead, his purpose, to us kids anyway, was to be provider and disciplinarian. If we got out of hand, which we did with startling frequency, my mother would threaten us by saying she was going to inform our dad when he got home. I have no idea why the very notion terrified us so, since my dad was not abusive. But I suppose it's because we didn't really know him. Our years in Minnesota had driven us together as siblings. For years, Micah, Dana, and I had been one another's only friends, and in Los Angeles that continued. We shared the same bedroom, played with the same toys, and were almost always in one another's company. On Saturday mornings, we huddled around the television to watch cartoons, and we could spend hours playing with action figures from the now-defunct Johnny West Cowboy series. Like G.I. Joe action figures, there were cowboys, the West family, Johnny, Jane, and the kids, soldiers, General Custer and Captain Maddox, an outlaw, Sam Cobra, and Indians, Geronimo, Chief Cherokee, and Fighting Eagle, as well as paraphernalia that included forts, cowboy wagons, horses, and herds of cattle. Over the years, we must have collected every item of the set three or four times over. We played with the figures, conjuring up one adventure after the next, until they literally fell apart. Because my sister was the youngest, she tended to stay inside with my mom while my brother and I gradually began to discover the outside world. My parents seemed to believe, rather naively I now think, that we'd be safe together, no matter how dangerous the streets were, and allowed us to freely explore the neighborhood on our own before I reached the age of 5. Our only requirement was to be home in time for dinner. Neither my mother nor father ever bothered setting limits on how far we could travel, as long as we upheld our end of the bargain, and we took this freedom to extremes. Wherever my brother went, I'd tag along behind him with a rapidly growing sense of hero worship. We'd spend our afternoons exploring run-down apartments or visit with our adult female neighbors as they stood along the boulevard soliciting customers. We could endlessly watch teenagers doing car repairs in the parking lot, and sometimes sat on the steps with various gangs as they drank beer and made out with their girlfriends. It was great fun. There was always something to see and do. And even when occasional gunshots sounded in the distance, I don't remember Micah or I ever being overly frightened by them. For whatever reason, we were safe there. I suppose it's because everyone, even gang members, knew that not only weren't we a threat, we were probably poorer than they were. We were desperately poor. As kids, we were raised on powdered milk, potatoes, and oatmeal. I didn't know milk came in liquid form until I headed off to school. We never went out to eat, visited museums, went to a ball game, or even a movie. The car my dad had purchased to get to work and the university had cost less than $100. Once we started school, we'd get one pair of shoes and one pair of pants a year. If they ripped, my mother would iron on patches and keep ironing more on until our jeans looked as if they'd been originally designed with knee pads. Our few toys, primarily Tinker Toys, Lincoln Logs, and the aforementioned Johnny West figures, had all been Christmas or birthday gifts. We gave up asking for anything we saw when we went to the store with my mom. It's only now that I realize that we were probably living well below the poverty line. We certainly didn't know it at the time, nor, to be honest, did we care. And my mom wouldn't have put up with our complaints, even if we did. My mom was a big believer in toughness. She hated whining, she hated moping, she hated excuses. And she was intent on eradicating these traits in her children. If we ever said something along the lines of, "But I want it," her response was always the same. She'd shrug and reply evenly, "Tough toenails, Tiger. What you want and what you get are usually two entirely different things." Her views on toughness would make most contemporary parents shudder. When Micah started school, for instance, school busing was being used to force greater integration of the inner-city schools. As a result, the school down the street wasn't open to him. Instead, he had to walk nearly a mile to the bus stop, along busy avenues, through rough neighborhoods, and with a shortcut through a junkyard. On the first day of kindergarten, she walked with him to the bus stop. The day after that, he walked by himself. Within a week, he told my mom that some older girls, seventh grade or thereabouts, but huge to a kindergartner, had cornered him in the junkyard and taken his milk money. Then they threatened him. They said that if he didn't bring them a nickel every day, that they were going to hurt him. "They said they're going to beat me up bad," Micah cried. There are a number of ways a parent could handle such a situation. My mom could have started walking him to school regularly, for instance, or walked with him one day, confronted the girls, and threatened to call the police if another incident occurred. Perhaps my mom could have found out who their parents were and talked to them, or found someone to carpool with. Maybe she could have even talked to someone at the school. Not my mom. Instead, After Micah told his story, she rose from the table and left the room for a few minutes. When she returned, she was carrying an old Roy Rogers lunchbox. Rusty and dented, it had been her younger brother's years before. "We'll put your lunch in this tomorrow instead of a brown bag," she said. "And if they try to take your money, just wind up and hit 'em with it, like this." Cocking her arm like a lion tamer, she began swinging the lunchbox in wide arcs, demonstrating while my brother sat at the table watching. The next day, my 6-year-old brother marched off to school with his hand-me-down lunchbox. And just as they'd threatened, the girls surrounded him when he wouldn't give them his nickel. When the first one charged, he did exactly as my mom had told him. In our bedroom that night, Micah related to me what happened. "I swung with everything I had," he said. "Weren't you scared?" With his lips pressed together, he nodded. "But I kept swinging and hitting them until they ran away crying." The girls, I might add, never bothered him again. In 1971, we moved again, this time to Playa del Rey, another section of Los Angeles. For obvious reasons, the nightly gunshots began sounding awfully close. Our parents believed it was safer for us than Inglewood. I'd started kindergarten by then, but given the years separating us and the fact that Los Angeles continued to bust my brother, Micah and I found ourselves in different schools. While the students in my class resembled students that might be found in an Iowa suburb, Micah was bused to one of the schools in the inner city and was the only white child in his class. Still, in the afternoons we were together, and we spent our time as we had in Inglewood, a couple of little kids with no fear of the world. We'd leave our apartment complex and spend hours going anywhere we wanted. We'd walk a couple of miles down to the marina where we'd look at the boats docked in their slips, or climb up the underside of highway bridges or utility poles looking for bird eggs, or explore vacant, decaying, or burned-out homes in search of something interesting that might have been left behind. Other times we'd head behind our apartment complex, cross a few avenues, and hop a few fences to visit the high school. In the late afternoons, it was usually empty, and we used to love the wide-open fields, which were much larger than the ones at our elementary schools. We'd race or hide or simply walk the hallways, looking into the classrooms. One day, we spotted a raven in the trees and were instantly captivated. We began following it as it moved from tree to tree. After that, whenever we went to the school, we'd look for the raven, and surprisingly, we'd almost always find it. After calling to it for a while, we'd head off to do something else. Yet, soon enough, we'd see the raven again, in one of the trees near where we were playing. Pretty soon, we weren't able to go anywhere near the school without seeing the raven. It was always around. The raven, we soon realized, was following us. We began to feed it. We'd toss some bread on the ground. The raven would swoop down and eat it, then fly away. Gradually, it stayed long enough for us to approach. From there, we moved to feeding it plums, and the raven grew more comfortable with us. We got to the point where we could hold the plum outstretched on the ground and the raven wouldn't hesitate to fly close and begin to eat. It struck us that it was becoming something of a pet, and we began to refer to it that way. Borrowing the camera from Mom, we were even able to take up-close pictures of it, and we proudly showed them off when the photos were developed. We named the raven Blackie. Blackie was great. Blackie was cool. Blackie, we eventually discovered, was a monster. As interested as we were in the bird, we found out that the bird had become far more interested in us, particularly our hair. Because we were blonde, our hair gleamed in the sunlight, and ravens, we came to discover, love shiny things. Ravens also build nests. Put one together with the other, and you can imagine what happened next. We were at the school one afternoon when Blackie suddenly came swooping toward us, diving at our heads over and over like a fighter plane attacking a ship. It was cawing at us, and we scrambled away. Blackie followed. His wingspan seemed to have grown exponentially overnight, and soon we were running and screaming for our lives as Blackie buzzed over our heads. We hid for a while near some dumpsters, trying to figure out how to get back home, and finally ventured out again. With the coast clear, we took off running. Keeping up with Micah was impossible, and gradually I slowed. In that instant, Blackie swooped down and landed on my head, which was quite simply the most terrifying thing ever to happen to me in my young life. I panicked, unable to breathe, unable to move a muscle. I could feel Blackie's claws digging into my head, and, as if to amplify the horror, Blackie began to peck hard, its head bobbing up and down like the oil pumps in Oklahoma. I screamed. Blackie pecked harder, and that's how it went. Peck, scream, peck, scream, peck, scream. peck, scream. It felt as if the raven was doing his best to drill a hole into my skull in order to suck my brains out. I vaguely remember my brother receding into the distance. He was oblivious to Blackie's return, until the first scream. Wheeling around, Micah ran back toward me, shouting at me to push the bird off. My mind, however, was blank, and I was frozen. All I could do was stand there while Blackie killed me, one peck at a time. Micah, of course, knew what to do. Screaming and waving his hands wildly, he was able to dislodge the evil demon bird from my scalp. Then, as Blackie continued to swoop at us, Micah took off his shirt and waved it around like a flag. Finally, Blackie retreated to the safety of the trees. On our way home, I was embarrassed by how frightened I'd been. Micah hadn't been frightened. Micah had taken on Blackie while I'd panicked. Micah fought while I froze. I came to believe that Micah, unlike me, could do anything. And as I struggled to keep up with him, I wanted more than anything to be just like him. Chapter 3. After confirming and reserving our places on the trip around the world, Micah and I began to make the necessary preparations. Among other things, we needed to obtain a number of vaccinations, including yellow fever and hepatitis A and B, as well as send off our passports for the visas for India, Ethiopia, and Cambodia. As spring turned to summer, my brother and I talked about the trip frequently. But strangely, the more we talked, the more our responses to the upcoming adventure diverged. While Micah grew more excited about the places we would see, I grew anxious at the thought of leaving. When he called wanting to talk about the trip, I found myself avoiding the subject. Call it buyer's remorse, but I gradually began to feel as if the decision to go had been a mistake. As exciting as the idea was, as much as I wanted to visit all those places, I couldn't imagine taking weeks to do it. Between work and family, time was the one thing that I hadn't had enough of in what seemed like ages. If my home life was chaotic, my career was even busier. And the thought of traveling for pleasure not only increased my anxiety, but left me feeling guilt-ridden. If I had a month to spare, shouldn't I spend the time with the kids? Or with my wife? If I barely had time to do everything now, how on earth could I even think of taking a month off to travel for fun? Everything about the trip felt wrong. But then, if you knew where I was in 2002, you would understand why. I like to think of life in terms of a stream, rapids, and waterfall. There are periods in everyone's life when things just seem to float along. You're in your canoe, paddling leisurely, enjoying the view. One day flows into the next, everything gets done, and somehow there's still time to relax. Then, ever so slowly, the stream starts to move faster. It's still possible to manage everything, but it takes a little more effort. Next come the rapids, and all of a sudden, everything is more challenging. Maybe there's a new project at work, maybe someone in the family gets sick, maybe you move or get laid off. Whatever the reason, you spend those periods steering the canoe, struggling to stay afloat. You wake up in the mornings feeling you're already behind, and each day becomes a frantic race against the clock in order to get everything done. And then the rapids begin to roil even faster, and you go right along with them. You have to. You need to. You have no other choice. You go, go, go. And in the distance you hear the roar of the waterfall, and you convince yourself that your only option is to paddle even harder. You've got to steer through those rapids and somehow get to safety, otherwise the waterfall's going to take you. That's where I was throughout 2002, in the middle of the rapids, steering frantically, with the waterfall growing louder. Mentally, physically, emotionally. And I'd been there for the previous 3 years. I'm not proud of this. It's not a sign of success. It's a life without any sort of balance. And in the long run, the waterfall will eventually take you. I know that now. The problem was that I didn't know that then. My wife, however, understood this. Kat is one of those rare people who find it easy to keep everything in perspective. She's not only an attentive mother, but has dozens of friends she talks to regularly. She is close to her family, and yet, as busy as she was, 5 children with 3 under 2 will keep any mom busy, she spent her days with none of the frantic urgency that I couldn't seem to escape. She, more than anyone, knew I needed an escape. She also knew that my natural inclination was to deny that I needed one, and to suddenly think of an excuse not to go on the trip. Or worse, refuse to enjoy it and relax, even if I did. Lying in bed one night, she asked me about the trip, and I mumbled again that I was having second thoughts. She rolled over and faced me. You'll have fun, she urged, and you need to go. You've never done something like this. I know, but it's not really a good time. It'll never be a good time to go. You'll always be busy. It's part of your nature. No, it isn't. Of course it is. In fact, you never let yourself not be busy. Just for the last couple of years, Kathy shook her head. No, sweetheart. You've been busy since I've known you. You can't not be busy. Really? Really. I thought about that. For the next couple of years, I'll be really busy, but after that, it'll slow down. In a couple of years, I'm sure I'll have time for something like this. You said the same thing a couple of years ago. Did I? Yes. I paused. I guess I was wrong then, but I'm sure I'm right this time. Beside me, I heard my wife sigh. Despite her words, my feelings of anxiety about the trip only grew stronger as autumn approached. My brother, like my wife, sensed my ambivalence on the phone and began to call more frequently, doing his best to bolster my interest. Hey, Nikki, Micah said into the receiver. Did you get the package TCS sent us? TCS was the company in charge of the tour. I was at my desk in the office working on my new novel, The Guardian. Stacked in the corner were two large boxes, still sealed, that had remained untouched for 2 weeks. Yeah, I got them, but I haven't opened them yet. Why not? I haven't had the time. Well, open them, he said. They sent us a bunch of cool stuff. They sent us a jacket, backpack, and suitcase, and other gizmos, too. There's also an itinerary. I'll get to it this weekend. You should open it now, he insisted. In fact, I think you were supposed to send in one of the health forms already. And you're supposed to make a decision about which site you want to see in Guatemala. It's either the ruins or the market downtown. You have to send that by the end of the week. I closed my eyes, fretting that something else had just been added to my plate. Okay, I said. I'll get to it tonight, if I get the chance. There was a long pause on the other end. What's wrong with you? He asked. Nothing, I answered. You don't sound like you're too excited about this. I will be, when it's time to go, I mean. Right now I've got so much work that I haven't had time to think about it much. I'll get more excited the closer we get. Right now I'm swamped. He took a deep breath. You're making a mistake, he said. What do you mean? Haven't you learned yet, he asked. The anticipation is an essential part of this whole trip. The excitement of going, the places we'll see, the people we'll meet, that's part of the joy of this whole thing. I know, but he cut me off. You're not listening to me, little brother. Never forget that anticipation is an important part of life. Work's important, family's important, but without excitement you have nothing. You're cheating yourself if you refuse to enjoy what's coming. I closed my eyes, knowing he was right, but still lost in all that I had to do. It's just that right now I've got different priorities. That's part of your problem, he said, his voice steady. You've always had different priorities. Where a suspension came to be a regular aspect of Micah's early school life, I found that I loved school. Everything about my first year was easy. My teacher was sweet, the kids were nice, and nothing we learned seemed difficult. Still, because he was a year older, Micah was nonetheless more advanced in most subjects than I. Or so I assumed. Our parents had us join the Cub Scouts, and one of our projects was to carve a wooden rocket powered by a CO2 cartridge and held in place by a wire, which we later raced against other rockets made by other Cub Scouts. Micah and I walked a couple of miles to the recreation hall alone, both of us nervous about how we would do. My rocket lost in the first round. Micah's won, however, and continued to win. In the end, Micah's rocket ended up placing second overall, and I was both proud of him and jealous at the same time. It was the first time I'd ever experienced the feeling of jealousy toward my brother, and the feeling only grew stronger when he received a red ribbon amidst applause. He could not only do everything, I realized, but do everything better than I. Meanwhile, the ribbon I received, which was given to everyone who, like me, hadn't placed, soon made me feel even worse. I was just learning letters and sounds. I could read small words, but longer words were often incomprehensible. I had no idea what the ribbon said. All I knew was that it was given to people who didn't do well. Still, I tried my best to read the ribbon. It had two words, and the second one was mention. I knew that much right away, but the first word didn't seem to make much sense, so I tried to sound it out. It started with an H-O, had an R in the middle, and ended with B-L-E. My lips began forming the word when I suddenly paled. Oh, no, I thought. It can't be. I stared at the word, trying to blink it away, but it was right there for everyone to see. The world began to spin as it finally dawned on me. Of course, I thought, it made sense. I felt my stomach lurch and I wanted to cry. In the distance, I could see my brother proudly showing off his rocket and ribbon, standing among the people who'd done great. Meanwhile, people like me had done exactly what the ribbon said. Horrible. They'd given me a ribbon that said, horrible mention. I don't remember leaving, but I do remember walking home. Micah knew I was upset, but I kept shaking my head when he asked why. Finally, when the feelings became too overwhelming, I thrust the ribbon toward him. See, I cried. I did horrible. That's what the ribbon says. Your ribbon doesn't say that. Look at it. He stared at the word, trying to sound it out like I had, then slowly looked up at me as if he were about to cry too. That's not very nice, he mumbled. Oh, no, I was right. I realized I'd been holding on to a ray of hope that somehow I'd read it wrong, that I'd made a mistake. But I hadn't, and I felt the dam holding back my emotions begin to burst. I tried my hardest, I really tried, I blubbered, and all at once I began to cry. My shoulders shuddered violently, and Micah put his arms around me, pulling me close. I know, and your rocket wasn't horrible. But they said it was. Who cares about them? I think your rocket was one of the best. No, you don't. Yes, I do. You did a great job with it. I'm proud of your rocket, and I'm not going back to Cub Scouts ever again. Not if they do something like that. I don't know whether his words made me feel better or worse. All I knew was that I needed him. By then I wanted to forget all about it, but Micah wouldn't let it go. I can't believe they said you were horrible, he kept murmuring in disbelief. And every time he said it, my shoulders slumped even more. When we finally reached home, we found my mom cooking in the kitchen. She turned toward us. Hey, guys, how'd you do? For a long moment, neither of us answered. Micah offered his ribbon, holding it low, almost as if embarrassed. I got second place, he said. My mom took his ribbon and held it up. Wow, congratulations, second, huh? I almost won, he said. Well, second place is great. How'd you do, Nick? I shrugged without answering, trying to hold back the tears. Her face softened. You didn't get a ribbon? I nodded. You did get a ribbon? I nodded again. It doesn't matter, though. Sure it matters. Can I see it? I shook my head. Why not, sweetie? Because, I finally said, beginning to break down. It says I did horrible. The tears started flowing, and I squeezed my eyes tight, trying to stop them. It doesn't say that, my mom said. Oh, yeah, it does, Micah said. It says he did horrible. I began crying even harder, and my mom put her arms around me. Can I see it? Perhaps it was the security I felt in my mom's arms, but I finally summoned the will to reach into my pocket and pull out the wrinkled ribbon. My mom glanced at it for a moment before using her finger to turn my chin toward her. It doesn't say horrible, she said. It says honorable. That's a good thing, sweetie. It's saying they're proud of the job you did. You did an honorable job. At first, I wasn't sure I heard her right. And a moment later, when she sounded out the word for me, I even felt a little better. Still, part of me wished I'd never received a ribbon at all. In 1971, a series of earthquakes convulsed Los Angeles. The first one struck in the middle of the night, and I remember waking up and feeling the bed shake violently as if someone were attempting to toss me out of it. Dana woke up about the same time and started screaming. I could hear the rumbling and crackling of the walls, saw toys toppling over. The ground was vibrating, looking almost like liquid, and though I didn't know what was happening, I knew it wasn't a good thing, and I suspected we were in danger. Micah understood this as well and jumped out of bed to grab my sister and me. He was pulling us to the center of the room as if to huddle when my dad came bursting through our bedroom door. He was buck naked and wild-eyed. None of us had ever seen him naked before, and the sight of him standing in the doorway was in some ways even more shocking than what was happening around us. My mom was right behind him. Unlike him, she was wearing a gown. Surging into the room, they enveloped us and forced us down to the floor, piling us together. Then they both lay on top of us in an attempt to protect us from falling debris. The ground continued to rumble, the walls continued to sway, but there was something calming about being heaped together as a family. As scary as it was, I remember suddenly feeling that we were going to be okay, that somehow this obvious sign of parental love and concern was enough to protect us. It wasn't until I saw the damage on television that I realized how bad it had been. Throughout the city, buildings had crumbled and freeways had buckled. The Richter scale had estimated the quake at a magnitude of 7.2. making it one of the largest quakes ever measured in the area. For my brother and me, the quake required that we inspect the damage ourselves, and we spent the next few days probing and searching like FEMA representatives. Perhaps it was our way of trying to get the fear out of our system, and it seemed to work during the daytime. At night, though, we'd lie in bed having trouble falling asleep and suffering from nightmares. The aftershocks continued for days after that first big quake. In the beginning, my